a Rayo Original Podcast.
Most of the people I talk to have no idea how much money they have. Your money mindset, which is also a kind of like your money behavior, mm-hmm. is shaped by the age 7. And I do see that. And without knowing the number that you're starting with, and hopefully maybe the number that you want to end with, how do you know how you're going to get there? Mm-hmm. So many people look at people's investment portfolios and say, well, I've never invested, so therefore I'm a failure. Well, they all started at nothing.
It is a really challenging topic.
We don't raise our next generation to feel confident enough to kind of push against it and be like, right, I want to learn.
One money habit everyone should stop immediately. Hello and welcome back to another episode of Rise with Roxy. Today we are talking about money. It's something that we all think about, stress about, and need, but so many of us were never taught how to actually understand it. From tax codes and pensions to budgeting, investing, and what financial freedom really means, money has somehow become one of the most important and yet the most taboo topics in our lives. Today's guest is here to change that. Abby Foster is a chartered accountant, personal finance expert, author of The Money Manual, and founder of Alent, a company on a mission to make financial education accessible, empowering, and jargon-free for everyone. This episode is all about taking control of your money, changing the way you think about it, and building confidence, no matter where you're starting from. Before we start, please don't forget to hit that follow button. We have new episodes every Monday and Thursday to help you rise up, rise again, and rise above. Abby, let's rise. Abby, welcome to Rise with Roxy. I am so excited for today's chat.
Thank you so much for having me. It's such a pleasure. So cozy.
Well, you look so snug, and I'm obsessed. For those of you who aren't watching on video, Abby has got my manifest book as the perfect accessory to her outfit, and I couldn't be more proud and also obsessed. Okay, I'm going to start with this question, which is, if you could correct one money myth that causes people the most anxiety, what would it be?
Comparing your everyday to someone else's highlight reel would probably be my first. If I had nothing else I could say, it would be don't look at there further down the road to your day one and think that you're failing because you're not there. So many people look at people's investment portfolios and say, well, I've never invested, so therefore I'm a failure. Well, they all started at nothing. Everyone's investment portfolio starts with nothing. And it's the same with all finance and even your money mindset. Like, it has to change at some point. Some people are very lucky that they have childhoods and maybe influences throughout their life where money is discussed and finance is a big conversation piece. And there are many people like myself where money really wasn't discussed at a young age. And therefore, I had to spend a lot of time in my teens, 20s, and even into my 30s now, changing my mindset around money. So yeah, if I could ask people to do one thing, it'd be don't compare yourself to other people's day 50 when you're on day zero.
And I think that is just like great advice across the board with everything, to be honest, isn't it? Okay, I've got so much I want to go through today, and I'm definitely going to ask a lot of questions about money and emotions and mindset and our kind of relationship to money, because I think it is so at the core of a lot of this. And I think even you say is that money is sort of rarely about just numbers. From your experience, how much of money behavior, and what is, firstly, can you define money behavior? And then also, how much of that do you think is shaped long before adulthood?
Well, when it's shaped, technically, there's this kind of stat that says your money mindset, which is also a kind of like your money behavior, is shaped by the age 7. And I do see that. So I teach finance in schools and I absolutely love it. And I teach from year one, which is age roughly 5-6, all the way through to year 13, so like 18. And you can tell the difference between kids that are talking about money at home and kids that aren't, because it's just the things that they come out with, the confidence they have around just discussing money and people that shy away from it. So I would say I do put a lot of weight into that money mindset being developed by age 7, because I see it firsthand in 7-year-olds.
That is so young.
It's incredibly young.
Okay, so what are kids saying that makes you think, yeah, that's being talked about at home?
Do you know what? Sometimes it's like phrases they use. Like they'll be like, well, my mummy says that money doesn't buy happiness. And I'm like, okay,
yeah,
cool, sure. Or they'll be like, no, there's no money left. Or they'll say like, my daddy hates paying taxes. And I'm like, all right, okay. And like, yeah, it's, you're just, you're building, they're building blocks of what they think life should be and look like. And all they've got to take away from is what their parents or their adults around them say. And so you do hear little phrases from young minds about finance and money. It often is what they've like subconsciously heard from their parents. Like, there are a lot of parents that say, I don't know what to talk about when it comes to finance with my kids. And I say, well, you're probably doing it without realizing, like, you're making financial decisions each day that they're going to be hearing that you don't realize that you're imparting on them. So just be really careful with it and be really careful with the like the words that you use around finance around them. Because from a young age, if they start to believe really limiting and say, think that money is scarce and that we can't afford anything, it really does instill in them this belief that they shouldn't even talk about it because it's like negative and rude. And that can be even more dangerous than when people just don't know anything.
Yeah. What would you say are like a couple of like, here are a few common phrases to avoid around kids and a few that you think would be like better, like switches?
Oh, it's hard to say because obviously each family and culture is different when it comes to money and what they believe is right to do with money. But what I would say to a parent would be, if you catch yourself being negative about money around your kids, just, I know it's impossible, it can be impossible in certain situations, but try and move it away from their very, very sensitive and impressionable ears and talk about it slightly differently. And if you are talking about money, maybe make it more educational and be like, right, we've only got this amount of money to spend on these things. What do you think? And kind of bring them in and be like, you know, engage that conversation around it. But also reaffirming that like, you can make more money, you know, by doing a job, or you can do, you can make more money from giving up your time to do something for someone else. That kind of thing is really important, just to not always talk about money in a really negative light, because it does directly fall into the ears of your young person, and then they grow up with those feelings.
Yeah.
You know, it's just part of life. Like, for instance, my mum is a hairdresser, and therefore a whole big part of my life has been making sure my hair always looked nice. It's just who I am. It does, I honestly don't think it's weird that as a 6-year-old I had my hair in rollers. Some people do.
Yeah.
But you know, and it's the same with money and lots of things. It's kind of what you're used to becomes your norm.
Yeah, it's so true. And so kind of, if it's starting so young, what do you think are then some of these kind of like common unspoken like beliefs or messages that we're hearing as young people, and that especially if you're looking at like our gen, like millennials and Gen Z, what have they been hearing that is maybe impacting and then carry that they're then carrying into adulthood?
Do a few things. I think one is that like successful wealth and like successful people, the bigger they get, sometimes the quicker they get torn down. You know, we see this from incredible women in our space that talk about their wealth and their life, and then somehow they get torn down for talking about it, which I think is really damaging. And I think it can do a lot of damage to the next generation, who then worry that if they then try and aspire to be the next Roxy, the next Amy Smale, that they'll be torn down for trying to earn that amount of money. And I think that's really sad and dangerous, because it stops, especially in young women, their growth. It really does hinder who they could become, because they're worried about, well, if I make too much money, then I'm just going to be torn down. And I really hate that. And then maybe the other one is that investing is still very masculine. You know, when I teach in the older years, so your year like 13, so if they're 18 years old, I always talk about investing. And usually all the boys' hands go up and all the girls' hands, a bit like not as interested, basically. They're kind of happy to be listening, but they still think of it as a very masculine like part of finance, and therefore won't get involved, which is, do you know what? Fine. You know, when it comes to this stuff, we're still in the process of feminizing it. And I think so, therefore, for a lot of young women, they think that if they engage with finance, that then they'll seem more masculine, which is ridiculous.
Where do you think all that comes from?
Oh, the fact that women weren't allowed bank accounts like on their own until like the 50s and 60s is a start. And if you look at any of the investment platforms, they're all very masculine and very finance bro. You know, you don't, it's not hard. You walk around bank in the city of London.
And
it's just quarter zips and gilets as far as the eye can see. And that isn't welcoming to a, you know, a young girl that's thinking, well, where do I fit into this? That would probably be my observations.
Why do you think that so many people internalize money struggles as a failure rather than seeing it as a sort of like lack of education, a mindset, something that's been kind of like put on them from younger years?
I think they take it as a failure because society has always told us that like if we're not incredible at something, then we must be a failure at it. And actually money, it's really hard to figure out what being incredible with money looks like, because I personally think success looks different for everyone. You know, you may be someone where financially you really want to own a home, and therefore getting to that point where you own your own home is success. Whereas for other people like myself, owning a home isn't really the metric I'm looking towards. Like I'm looking towards building wealth in other ways, mm-hmm. and looking to buy other things that make me happy. And so therefore, if you put us up against each other, technically on their metric, I'd be failing because I actually rent rather than own. Whereas in the other way around, if they tried to invest the way I invest, it would make it harder for them to buy their first home. So then it'd be the other way around. So I think, yeah, the majority is comparing yourself to other people, which I think across the board, obviously, is something that hurts a lot of us more than it helps. But it would be that.
I think lots of different emotions can come up with money, you know, and a lot of those emotions are ones like fear, shame, perhaps like a need for control. How are those emotions actually impacting our everyday money habits?
Oh, it's the fear. It's the fear that's the biggest problem, because that stops us from investigating our finances. So for instance, around your income, so many people don't read their payslip. I go on and on about this. I'm almost like, I'm worried that people are going to be like, could you just
no,
stop?
I want to hear it.
I know, but someone called me the queen of tax codes the other day, and I was like, that's really the flex I was looking for. But why not? Let's go with it. So when it comes to, yeah, the biggest problem is like fear around money leads to them complete avoidance. So they don't look at their payslip every month. They don't look into their money leaks. They don't look into all of these things that could be helping them in the future or kind of hindering them right now. So yeah, so many people I know tell me that they don't read their payslip because they don't know what it means, which is absolutely fine because we don't teach it at school, and therefore why would anyone know? You know, even my first job, I thought at some point someone will tell me what's going on, right? And they just never do. No one tells you. You just sort of have to figure it out. And if you don't have parents that talk about money at home, or you don't have parents that had traditional PAYE jobs and therefore had payslips, they don't know. So you don't know what you don't know. And then that leads to more fear, because then you just avoid the payslip and you just hope and pray that your money that's coming in every month is right. It's not guaranteed, because your payslip is actually your responsibility, and not a lot of people realize that. And then, yeah, it falls into other elements as well. You know, we don't look into our bank statements because we're worried what we'll see. And then we don't realize that every month there's like two subscriptions coming out for the exact same thing. But because you don't look, you don't know. And because it's small and it might be £15 here, £20 there, you don't realize that it adds up over such a long period of time, and it's creating effectively leaks in your life. But avoidance is the worst part of it. We just put our heads in the sand. And I think that comes from what we've been talking about, which is we don't raise our next generation to feel confident enough to kind of push against it and be like, right, I want to learn. And I would love to see that change, to be honest. And that's why I do what I do on social media, is to make people feel like it's completely within their control, and it's completely doable, and it's super simple. Like if I can explain it to my mum, who is like a I won't out her age, but she's older than me, and she's a hairdresser, and she's never really engaged in finance. And if I can explain it to her and she can like sort of get it, then anyone should be able to get it.
Yeah. Could you please explain what a PAYE is?
Yeah. So if someone is considered PAYE, often what we're referring to is them being employed by someone else. So they have a pay slip where they pay their income, like someone else is paying their income tax and their national insurance on their behalf. That's PAYE. It stands for pay as you earn, as opposed to someone that's self-employed.
And I think it's true. Like I do get, you know, when you are so overwhelmed by something, that fear, it is that kind of like fight or flight response. And well, it's fight, flight or freeze, isn't it?
Yeah.
And so I think that you want to run from the situation. You don't want to face it. You don't want to look at your bank balance. You don't want to look at your statement. You know, there is something like deeply overwhelming about it. And there is a sense of like panic that can come up when any bill comes through the door, or, you know, whatever it is. And like, it's so, I really just feel for people. Is it just because people don't have the education that they just think, oh my God, I I'm not good enough at finances to be able to cope with what I might find.
Yeah, that is genuinely the genuine consensus. When I ask all of the people, I'm like, what stops you? And they think, well, or they say things like, I'm not good at maths. That's fine. You don't have to be good at maths to mm-hmm. be good at finance. Also, they'll be like, oh, it's just something that I don't get. And it's just who I am. I'm just not good with finances. I hate that. If someone says, oh, I'm just never good at finance. I'm like, no, come on. Come, let me hold your hand. Let's go forward. We can change this, because it's almost like we don't hear as many people say that about like reading or words. Like people, you wouldn't hear someone be like, oh, I've never been able to read, so I'm not going to bother. Like, and I think for some reason, when it comes to finances, people are very comfortable saying like, oh, I've never been good at I've never been good at math, so therefore I'm not bothered about my finances.
Yeah.
And that, yeah, that is something that really frustrates me. And I feel like if we could stop people in their tracks and say, honestly, the hardest part is just kind of having it open and like having the numbers in front of you. It can be as simple as whenever at the month, you get an Excel sheet up or a piece of paper. If Excel freaks you out, that's fine. A piece of paper, and you just write down all of the accounts that you have and how much is in them. That can honestly be most like the biggest ground break, because you can go, ah, right, that's how much money I have. Whereas most of the people I talk to have no idea how much money they have in total. They have a rough ballpark figure, and they know maybe they've got some money here, maybe there's some money there, but they don't know to the number. And when they know to the number, they can start to like go forward from there and go, right, well, what can I be doing to make that look better for me? And what does wealthy look like to me? What does financial freedom look like to me? And without knowing the number that you're starting with, and hopefully maybe the number that you want to end with, how do you know how you're going to get there?
Yeah. Okay, let's sort of start helping people then, because I think that we understand that, look, it's this lack of education, there's a lot of fear, there's a lot of shame, there's a lot of avoidance. And you're here to kind of really give people some information so that they can start to feel like they're better equipped to deal with their finances. Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's start with somebody who is really afraid to open their banking app. They don't want to look in there. They don't want to see what's behind it. Where do they start?
Oh, I hate to say this, but it's kind of a rip the Band-Aid off situation. Mm-hmm. You have to open the app and look at the number that's in there, and then if you can, download the last month. Not more than that, just the last month of expenses and like ins and outs, and go through them and just have a list in front of you and like kind of color. You can write on it, you can highlight it depending on what it is. The easiest thing to do is go through line by line and check that you are aware of everything that's coming out. Just being aware, that's fine. That's all you need to do. If the first and only thing you've given me 10 minutes of your time, that's what I would suggest is find the final number, download the last month, and just go through and check that you are aware of everything that's coming out. Mm-hmm. Because for so many people, it's, you know, they open that bank statement and they're like, what is that every month? And they don't realize that there's a small subscription that comes out or even right to the kind of catastrophe element of their card might be being used for something that they never accepted. So it's really important, because obviously fraud and all of that happens all the time, and it plays on the vulnerable, and the vulnerable are the people that don't engage with their finances because they don't know it's happening. And that worries me the most. Like, a lot of young people and older people are the most likely ones to be impacted by scams and fraud because of their resistance to get involved with their finances.
Yeah. One of the things I find the most annoying is that all these companies have different company bank names to what you're actually purchasing. So I'll go through my bank statements and I'm like, who the fuck was that to? What is that payment? And I'm like going out of my mind. And then I'm like, oh, that's like, you know, my office Wi-Fi.
Yeah.
But like the name is so obscure and it's so frustrating.
Yep.
And I find that that can also get you in a bit of a panic.
Yep.
Because like there are times where I'll be like, well, I'm obviously being scammed of all this money. And then I'm like, oh no, I'm literally not. That was all me.
Yeah, I know. It's really it's so frustrating. It is as simple as just obviously a quick Google, because most of them, if you like Google the company names, it'll explain to you if that's the parent company, the subsidiary.
It's so obvious. I'm like, why did I not do that?
No. But this is the thing with finance. I think this is a thing, is something that I kind of realized in the last few years, because someone said, why do you do what you do? And I was like, I didn't realize that I find this all, I'm like, well, it's so simple. And then I realized actually, no, it's not. I just realized actually there is a way that we can do this where we can explain it simply. And we can go, instead of all the finance bros out there that purposely make the acronyms and the analogies so masculine and so confusing. Why don't we do this differently? And yes, we make it just really, really, really simple.
Yeah. Yes. And how important is it, do you think, that at this stage, while people are building awareness, what should they really look for when they're going through their bank statement?
Oh, I was going to say, going back to my PACIP thing. So if I had like one takeaway from, if we're going through each, so that one, you're starting the month, let's say you're starting with your income coming in and you look at your PACIP, check that your PACIP, like your take home pay, matches what the pay is in your bank statement. You never know, things can go wrong. And then when you're looking at your PACIP, you want to look for three things, I would say. I would say the first is that your tax code is right. So the standard tax code in the UK is like 1257L. And it refers to how much income you can earn before you start paying tax. If yours isn't that, doesn't necessarily mean yours is wrong. I would just personally go and check, because there are, for a lot of people, that is the standard. Until you start earning over £100,000 and then £125,000, that it will change for that reason.
And who do you check with?
So if it's, for instance, you look at your PACIP now and it's not 1257L, you want to check on the HMRC or the Gov website. There's HMRC have an app as well, which you can check on. Mm-hmm. And what it will say on there is if your tax code on your PACIP and that one matches, it will say next to your tax code why, like there'll be a little description as to why yours isn't the standard. Mm-hmm. If they don't match, you need to tell HMRC to tell your employer. Right. To change yours. I know it's really annoying. Mm-hmm. And it's also, that's why I say your PACIP, your responsibility, because a lot of mm-hmm. people think that their payroll team, their company will just sort all of this for them. It's not actually guaranteed.
Yeah.
You have to be the one to get involved. So that would be number one, would be check your tax code. Secondly, would check how much you're putting into your pension. When it comes to the UK, we have something called auto enrollment mm-hmm. where when you're over the age of 22, earning more than 10K a year, your company will put in 3%, you put in 5% as a standard. You can opt out, which means your company doesn't have to put in anything, but check what you are currently contributing, because some employers will match higher. And if mm-hmm. you're not matching what they're willing to put in, you could be just leaving money on the table. Mm-hmm. And then my third thing
is... And I want to talk more about pensions later.
Oh, don't you worry. Yeah. We've got plenty to talk about pensions. And the third thing I would say is any other deductions on your PACIP. So for instance, salary sacrifice in any capacity, but also student loan. A lot of people don't realize in their like 30s and 40s that they're edging towards paying that student loan off. And the student loans company rarely come to you to make you aware that you're finished. You're almost
really?
Finished.
What, so they'll keep charging you?
Sometimes your employer will keep deducting, and then it will take a while for the student loan company to be like, oh, you've overpaid. Would you like this money back? You're like, yeah, I would actually, thank you. So I always say to people, if you think you're near the end, I am nowhere near the end. I'm on like the plan two when it hiked up to 9K. But if you think you're near the end of paying that off, do a double check, because you could stop your employer from paying the student loan out of your PACIP and just do pay it yourself. Mm-hmm. And then you know how much is going out. And then when it's done, it's done.
Yeah.
And also some people find that they're on the wrong plans, and that means you're paying the wrong amounts. So those would be my top three, would be tax code, pensions, and any other deductions like student loans to check in on. That would be where we're starting on our bank balance. Yeah. And then, like I said before, with the expenses, I would first be looking for any expenses you don't recognize. Obviously, doing a double check that it was you. I've had it before. I've done it where I've seen something. I'm like, I've been scammed. My account's been hacked. And unfortunately, I wasn't, which is very upsetting. And then check that if you've got any like automations going out, so any subscriptions, what's going on there? Mm-hmm. Do you really need them? Do you really use them? Things like that. That'd probably be where I would start. This should be completely without judgment. Do you know the phrase I've really enjoyed recently? This woman was like, I'm high maintenance, but it's fine because I'm the one maintaining me. And I'm just obsessed with it, because I think it goes along with your finances as well. Like, be inquisitive about your finances, because you're the one maintaining it.
Yeah.
And actually, I think more people need to kind of take that on and remember that it's not about judgment. It's your finances. It's personal to you. And if there's something wrong, go and seek someone out. Go and seek support. But avoiding it is not going to help anyone. And actually, you're not maintaining you. I think personally, I would say it goes along the same lines of like brushing your teeth and doing your skincare. But obviously, I would say that because I'm an accountant.
Yeah.
But I do think if we could get to a place where people felt comfortable enough that it was just part of their maintenance routine, it would be wonderful.
You recommend a 1-week spending check-in.
Yes. Well, I've limited it sometimes to 24 hours. It depends if I really want the item. Yeah. But yes, if you're spending over a certain amount of money, taking a pause and giving yourself at least 24 hours, if not a week, before you go back to your finances, before you go back and purchase the item is a really good idea. Mm-hmm. I think in my book, I did specifically say a week, but sometimes we have to limit it because, you know, the item really needs to purchase. But I would always say, if you want to buy something over a certain amount of money, because that comes alongside when you're looking at your bank statements, you know you've got purchases coming up, speaking to someone about it, like having a kind of an accountability spending buddy, and then going, right, I'm going to wait 24 hours before I buy it, and then I'm going to buy it, or I'm going to wait a week before I buy it. Because sometimes, not all the time, but sometimes you'll find that when that 24 hours has passed, actually the need or the want isn't there anymore, and it kind of passes, and you think, actually I'll wait. And
I would say a lot of the time, especially because of, like, I was telling the girls, like, I'm not really a big shopper. Like, I'm not a frivolous spender at all.
Yeah.
I like spending money on, like, holidays and, my home, but, like, shopping on the internet, clothes, that kind of thing. It's just, I'm not into it. It just it's not my dopamine hit. But something has happened in the last month, and those fucking Instagram ads...
targeting you.
They have got me. Yep. Like hook, line and sinker. I got £20 hand steamer from Amazon yesterday, which is actually incredible.
Yeah.
Then I tell everyone about it. I bought this like £60 like total amazing ad for like this like blow dry brush. Yep. I bought a 10th iPod like iPhone tripod that I don't need, but it just looked like it bent in a cool way.
Yeah.
I am just a sucker at the moment.
Oh,
and it's dopamine.
Yeah.
It is that like hit, and it's always just before I go to bed. It's like I need a quick hit before I sleep. This is getting out of control.
I know. My guilty pleasure is bulk loo rolls. I know.
Yeah, so every time I do a zap, I always add that to
honestly,
my order.
Honestly, it's like ticked. I don't know what it is, but I'm like, this is such a great deal. And also, who likes walking back from the shop with loo rolls?
No, never.
One.
Agreed.
And so I get them delivered to me, but they are hysterical. And my friends end up seeing me around the loo roll delivery slot leave with loo rolls, because I actually live in a really small flat and I buy them, and they're like, they're bigger than, honestly, it gets delivered probably about the size of this sofa. I know. And then I'm looking at it like, oh, I made a really terrible decision here. And so everyone that turns up, I'm like, do you want some loo rolls? And they're like,
that
go on then. And then
hilarious.
They leave. And it's, yeah, that's my guilty pleasure, is like bulk buying stuff. And I think it's like a, maybe it's a mindset from my childhood, but from my parents. I don't know. But I just go, well, it's such a great deal. Of course I'd spend £24 on a million loo rolls.
Oh my God, that is so funny.
Yeah, I have the same as well with clothes. Like I used to be someone that would just go out and buy whenever I felt the need. And I, especially being thrust into this social media world, I felt the constant need to keep leveling up my clothes. And as a woman, I would go into these incredible spaces like Downing Street and Bank of England, and the boys would be wearing the exact same suit they've worn for the last 10 appearances.
Yeah.
But I didn't feel like I could do that. I felt like I had to wear a different dress or a different outfit each time. And actually, I've got an incredible friend called Kate, who's now stylist, and she really helps me, because if I go to buy something, I'll send a picture to her and she's very brutal with me, and she'll be like, absolutely not, don't touch that.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh, I thought it looked great. She's like, no.
And
it will help stop me from buying things, because if I haven't got the approval, I'm not buying
it.
Which can be good sometimes. I think some people need their own finance version of that.
Yeah, but I like the pausing, because I think it takes that sort of impulsive buy, which really is just to like satisfy some kind of urge in the moment. And it so often is, you know, I mean, the fact is I'm starting to forget what I fucking ordered. Let's talk a little bit about budgeting.
Yes.
I think when we hear the words, let's say that someone said to us, you know, maybe you should start budgeting, I think immediately we can almost take that as like an insult, like someone saying like, you're clearly not good with money, or you clearly don't have enough money, you need to start restricting yourself. Mm. And I think that can feel like you almost want to rebel against it, or it can just make you feel like not very good. Mm-hmm. How can we reframe budgeting to something that is really about self-worth, self-respect, protection, rather than this restriction?
Yeah, it does. It sounds and does feel like that. You know, that all those like random or standard budgeting hacks, like the 50-30-20 method, which is basically about like 50% of your income goes to your needs, 30% goes to your wants, and then 20% goes to your like future you pot. I actually think, you know, it's so difficult, especially if you live in central London, to find like your rent it's under 50% of your salary, and your bills on top of that and things like that, it just feels restrictive and stressful. So I would say, I wouldn't even call it budgeting. I'd call it, can't start with automation, but the good type of automation. So not the subscriptions that are coming out, but start at the beginning of the month, moving all your money around to where it should be. So put good, really good finance habits in place. So when you know your payday is happening, so it's happening on the 26th of the month, let's say, you've already organized on the 26th of the month, £100 goes straight into your investment portfolio, £100 goes into your savings pot, £100 goes into that savings account that's specifically for your holiday in September. All of those things just happen quickly and you can set them up. It's a little bit of a faff to begin with, but then they just happen each month. And that almost is, like, people don't think that that is budgeting, but that is budgeting, but it's just happening for you.
How do you create little pots?
It depends on your bank company or like the bank you're using, but it is quite simple. Like, there's lots of neobanks now, those like new banks that will let you set up pots and let you set up automations, and you can set up standing orders in any bank account. Like, to be honest, all of them do it now because they know they have to. Even the old archaic banks have had to get on board with the new era. So yes, it's not a simple, it's not too difficult. If you go on your account and then click standing orders.
It sounds so fun. Well, exactly.
I love a bit of organisation. This is a thing. We're getting, what's her name? Marie Kondo, where she like organises her closets. Do it with your finances. Like, organise your bank accounts. Like, you know, move it, move a bit of money to premium bonds. Go wild. You know, move a bit of money to your investment portfolio. Move your money around, but make it, like, spend time at the beginning automating it, and then you don't have to do it again. Because then when you get to the 27th of the month, you can look at your bank account and be like, right, that's what I have to spend this month. And I've paid myself first in all of my different pots. And now what's left is what I've got left. And I think that's a really good place to start. You know, we can then go into more minute detail and you can start using different methods to make sure you don't overspend in different places. But I personally would start with automation of all of your money go into a different pot, and then spend what's left rather than trying to save what's left at the end of the month.
I love that. I feel like that sounds like exciting. Because also I think when you could always also do that. Like, I love the idea of doing it for something like a holiday or something that you know that you maybe like a home purchase or like something for the home. Obviously, I'm thinking that because I'm renovating at the moment. But, you know, something big that you really want. I also think there's quite a lot of joy in that. Like, knowing that you're going to put this money inside for this thing that you really want, that you want to experience, that you desire, that you know that you deserve.
Yeah.
And then working towards it yourself in that way that feels like manageable. Because I think, in that sense, actually, when you then make the payment for it, it's going to feel like you're doing it from a positive place rather than a like, oh shit, the time has come and now I've got to put myself in a really tricky position because I've got to pay for all of it at once. And then it can almost put a downer on booking the holiday or a downer on doing that thing that you were so excited about before.
Yeah. And actually, it's, you can make a pot that's literally just called fun money. And then when you're out and you're thinking, you know, I really want this thing. Maybe you've waited 24 hours, you know, and you come back and you're like, I really want it. And you can go, do you know what? I put the money aside and I am allowed to buy things with my money. I think often when people speak to me about finances, they're very nervous and they're like, oh, I'm embarrassed to tell you. And I'm like, no, I make frivolous purchases all the time.
Yeah.
Because I love spending my money. That's the point. And I think it's a mindset part as well that I think people, when they start to say things like, oh god, I can't spend any money, I don't have enough, it does create it, like, leads to you being worse with money. On a more serious note, I would say, though, you know, the savings pot's really important, but what's really important is your emergency fund pot and your freedom pot as well. You know, having savings set aside that give you the ability to say no or to say yes when you need to, i.e. say no to a job that doesn't suit you, say yes to an opportunity that works for you, and having that money there, especially as a woman, gives you so much more freedom.
Realistically, how much is enough for, let's say, like an emergency pot or a...
Do you know what? Technically, the rule for an emergency fund pot, the rule, is 3 to 6 months of essential spend. It should be in an account that's easy to access. If something happens, you can get that money quickly rather than like leaning on debt. However, for a freedom or an FU pot, you've sworn, so we're great, we're fine. I like to call it the fuck you pot, but I would say start small and work your way up to a point where you feel comfortable with it. So, like, for instance, my fuck you pot used to genuinely just have enough money to get me home. If I was on a terrible day or I was in a terrible place in London, I wanted to just get home, I could just get an Uber and not worry about it and like not like grill myself that like I should have got the train or the tube, you know, as a woman, it's never that simple, you know. And actually, I think sometimes that pot can just be there just to be like, I'm getting an Uber. Or it can be as big as, I've been in a relationship for a very long time that I am really unhappy in, but I feel stuck. What do I do? And you go, well, actually, I've got a savings pot there that's specifically for this. It's specifically there to help me go, no, I don't need to accept this anymore from this man. I can go and leave because I know what's going on. I have my money. I'm ready. And actually, that's what I would love to be like teaching that next generation, is that money is there to give you ultimate freedom. It's not there to be a measure of like who you are as a person. Like having more money than someone else doesn't make you better, but what it should do is give you ultimate freedom to be able to do and like act how you want in your life and not feel like you're stuck. There's so many women that come to me that feel like they can't leave relationships because financially they're trapped, and that breaks my heart, because I think as someone that came out of a relationship recently, having my financial ducks in a row made the process so much more seamless.
I think that's honestly so, so important. And do you have a kind of message for someone who thinks, okay, that sounds really great in theory, but I don't even feel like I'm earning enough, like to even put away anything? Like how small is enough? Like anything, what is enough, right?
Anything. It start like, because you'll be amazed, even if you put the money, you wake up and you go, do you know what? I won't get a coffee today. I hate this analogy, to be honest, sometimes, but like I won't get the coffee and I'll just put £5 into that savings pot. It's the mindset that shifts in your brain. Like something does shift, I promise you it does.
Yeah.
And you put £5 away, and then next week you go, do you know what? Actually, there's £10 there. Let me put that away. Then you just make small decisions, and before you know it, that savings pot has accumulated into something that you just feel proud of. And feeling proud about you're feeling proud of yourself is what's really important in all of this. Like, it's why I wrote the books I've written and teach what I teach, is because I just want people to feel proud of themselves and feel like that money doesn't hold them back. Because for years, we've just been taught that money is something that we shouldn't be talking about, and it's taboo, and it's bullshit.
It is so taboo.
Yeah.
So taboo. I mean, my mum was always saying to me, like, never talk about money. Like, never. Do you know what I mean? It was like really rude. Even now, if I tell my mum, like, I used to be able to talk to my dad about it because he like was, you know, loved finances and business and everything. But if I tell my mum now, I'm like, oh my God, mum, like, you know, this happened, she'll be like, shh, don't talk about it. I'm like, mum, you're my mother. I can tell you. You know, it's really like, it's really destructive to discuss money in any way. And I think that even, you know, when it comes to me talking about manifestation, you know, I never talk about manifestation and money, because I know how triggering it can be for so many people, because I think it is a really challenging topic, and I'm so conscious not to offend or upset anyone.
Do you know what I would say though? Like, I do think there's so much behind manifesting and visualization and all of that when it comes to money, because what we're trying to do is build up our confidence. Like, I think a lot of people, the main reason they don't engage is just the lack of confidence. And so if we can fix the confidence element, we can fix the money element. I can give you the tools to teach you about PaySips. It's very boring, but I can do that. I can teach you how savings accounts should work. I can teach you how investing works. But if I'm trying to work from a place where you've got no confidence in yourself whatsoever, it's pretty difficult to do that. And I think it's really important that you sort of create, even if you have to fake it at the beginning, like create this sort of alter ego of someone that just speaks well. You don't have to speak amazingly about money, but speaks well about money and speaks well about yourself. And that's what I love about Manifest and about what you do in general, is it's about just building out your confidence in general, and then you can slot in the other boring bits on the side if you want.
Totally. Yeah. No, I love that. I want to talk a little bit about the kind of generational money shift. I think that money definitely, it feels a lot harder to make money now than it did for our parents' generation. And I think that, you know, basic things like what £1 million would get you today is so different to what it meant for our parents. The idea of, you know, being able to afford a home. How different is the financial landscape for us compared to them?
Huge. They could buy houses for like Haribo.
Yeah.
Like my parents' generation, you know, you were looking at buying a house that was maybe 5 times your salary max, you know, maybe 4 times your salary. Now we're looking at 12, 15, 20 times.
Wow, like,
it's that not much, you know, and it's and you know, most people have to buy with someone else, So they have to make decisions really early on in their lives that they're like, right, okay, am I with this person? Because then I'm going to buy with them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think there's some good habits that our parents' generation had around money. I do. But I was listening to Robin Sharma's podcast with you, and he was saying that hold on to your habits with a loose grip. And I think that that's what the next generation need to remind themselves, that the habits of our parents aren't the habits of us today. You know, our parents could get mortgages by walking into a bank and being like, here's a piece of paper with what I earn. Please give me a mortgage. And they went, okay, great. Here's your mortgage. Yeah. That doesn't happen now. We now have to go to a mortgage advisor or a bank and be like, this is everything I have. Also, by the way, I've spent a serious amount of thousands of pounds on student loan because everyone told me I had to go to university. I have various credit card debts because of lifestyle creep or, you know, the internet, what encouraged me to buy loads of loo roll. You know, there's loads of different things, and you have to, they can see everything about you. And you often then go, right, I can build up a deposit, just maybe 5-10% of a house. And then you're going, right, I need a mortgage. What does that look like? Where can I buy? Where is it close to where I work? And, you know, our parents just didn't really have that. They really didn't. And as much as my parents would be like, oh, it was difficult in our day, we had higher interest rates. And I'm like, yes, but you had higher interest rates based on like you were borrowing less money. So it isn't the same thing.
Yeah.
You know, we have an age where, you know, you're saying it isn't as easy to have pay rises anymore, and house prices don't rise as quickly as they did in our parents' generation. So, you know, wealth has changed. What does wealthy look like as well? Many people that are in my life don't value owning a home, but they value travel. They want to be a digital nomad. They want to be able to see the world. And actually, that's what their money provides them. And they are incredibly wealthy because they have seen so much of the world and get to live that life. Whereas like my parents' generation probably think that what we do is mad and that we're being frivolous with our money. But like I said, or like Robin said, hold your habits with a loose grip, because our parents' generation or our parents' habits shouldn't be the ones that we hold on to, because a lot of them were fearful of investing because it was more risky back then. It felt riskier back then.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're so right that like home ownership was definitely such a clear milestone. Like that is the kind of like point, that's like a destination. You want to get to that point, and then you have some financial security, or you have reached financial success in some way.
Yeah.
And it's very clear that that is changing. But I think for some people, but for a lot of people, they still really hold on to that. What would you say to those people who still think like are panicking about the fact that they can't afford to buy a home, or they don't know how that will ever happen for them?
Yeah, that it's absolutely fine. You know, like life isn't meant to be, we aren't meant to live the same lives as our parents. And if you don't own a home, but you can say that you're genuinely happy, that that's fine. You know, owning a home, if you want to own a home, as the accountant in me can give you tips to be like, use things like a lifetime ISA. So a lifetime ISA is this like government thing where you can put in 4K, the government uplift this by 1,000 each year. You can keep contributing to that until you buy your first home. You could speak to a mortgage advisor, make sure that you're on track to know what you need as a deposit, what you need for a salary wise to get a decent mortgage. But the kind of other part of me would say that, you know, sometimes renting is much more freeing because you can leave when you want, effectively, well, within reason, within your rental period, but you can leave. The boiler breaks, it's not your responsibility. You know, whereas when you own, it's all your job. And I used to own. I owned with someone, and I now don't own and I rent, and I actually find it more freeing, and I'm okay with that. But if you are adamantly set on buying a home, fantastic, great, that's a metric that you're working towards, and you can, like, if you know, if you put like things in place, hopefully you'll reach it.
Amazing. Okay, I wanted to do a kind of quick fire on money terms explained before we go any further, because I think part of this kind of like resistance to understanding money is the fact that there's these terms used, and most people feel too embarrassed in a conversation to say, I'm so sorry, I actually don't know what that means.
Yes.
Okay, so, okay, number one, interest rates. So interest rates come in two parts.
Yes.
It's either when you've got a set amount of money in your bank. So let's say you have £1,000 in your bank and you're receiving interest.
Yes.
Or you're borrowing £1,000 because you need it, and then you get an interest rate on top. Can you explain the difference between those two and what's happening?
Exactly. So banks, traditional high street banks, will basically charge you money if they're lending you money. So if you've borrowed £1,000 from a bank, they'll charge you what's called an interest rate. So you pay back what's called the principal, so that £1,000, and then the interest on top of that, which we, let's just say it's 6%. It can happen the other way around. If you have put £1,000 into a savings account with a bank, the bank might say, thank you so much, we're going to give you 6% or probably 5% interest. Mm-hmm. And what happens is you get, at the end of the year, you've got your £1,000 plus 5% on top of that. And that will be what's in your bank account. And the way banks make money is the difference, basically, is that they are going to be lending out your money to person B and your person A for 6%, but they're only giving you 5%.
Okay, inflation.
Inflation. What is inflation? Inflation is the price rise over a period of time. Mm-hmm. So if you take a basket of goods at January 2024, you take that same basket of goods in Jan 2025 and you compare them, the prices, how much has the, all of those prices risen on average? So that's what our UK inflation rate is doing each time it comes out.
And very simply, what is contributing to inflation?
The reason we have price rises can be a whole mix of things. It could be price rises for the transport it takes to get that good from one place to another. So if oil prices rise, the cost of that good will go up. If the cost of manufacturing that good, so people's time starts to cost more as wages rise, that means that product becomes more expensive. Or it can be something like demand. If the demand for that product has risen, the price might rise because of that as well.
Okay. Compound interest.
Compound interest, the eighth wonder of the world. That is the, basically, we talked about interest rates. So we had our £1,000 and we were getting 5% on year one. And then what happens the next year is you're not getting 5% just on the £1,000. You're getting 5% the second year on the £1,000 plus the 5% you had in the first year. So it's compounding each year. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Fantastic.
Essentially, to someone who's just like, what? It's like you're snowballing your money.
Exactly. You're never starting. You're not doing 5% on day one. You're doing 5% of your day 365.
Yeah. Okay. Net versus gross income.
Oh, love this one. This is payslips. Net is your take home pay. So that is what will land in your bank account versus your gross income is the top number that you get at the top of your payslip. And that is pre everything coming out. So that's pre your pension coming out, your taxes, your student loan. That's the gross. And what people often will know is they'll have their gross income in an annual salary quoted to them to say you're on £60,000 a year. That's called your gross income. But what you actually take home is that 60 less your pension contributions, your student loan and your taxes gives you your net.
Cost of living. just, you know, I think it's just because let's say someone puts on the news.
Yes.
Or they hear someone talking about something and there are these terms that get talked about a lot. And if somebody there is listening going, I don't actually know what they mean by this, then it's just like immediate shutdown. So yeah, just a, something simple just so someone can feel less like, ah!
Yeah. The cost of living, very much we're talking about the cost of living crisis, which is what we've been having in the last few years. And that is all because of inflation, really. Inflation has been rising and it means everything is becoming more expensive to everyone. And the cost of living has been rising statistically more in the last few years than it has for a number of years before that. Mm-hmm. So we're talking about energy bills have gone up. The cost of rent has been skyrocketing. And do you know what? And not to be controversial, but it has been because of COVID. And I think a lot of people don't realize that. We printed money during COVID for furlough and to support everyone that needed it. Absolutely fine. But that money was going to have an impact at some point. And that's what's happening now is we then had to see interest rates rise and the cost of everything has risen because we printed money. And I think that's something that we haven't really articulated very well as a country to everyone, that we are in this cost of living crisis. Because of, yes, maybe because of war, other things have had a factor, but also because we printed money during 2020.
But what does that mean to like print money? Like, can you not just like, I don't know, like when I think about it, I'm like, yeah, you just print some more stuff. Like, yeah. How is that impacting us?
Yeah, so it's supply. Because basically when you...
You can't just print endless amounts.
No, unfortunately, no. There is something, like you have supply and demand and it's if you're increasing the supply of something, basically it becomes worth less. Does that make sense? And so that's what happens with our money is you can have something called hyperinflation like that's happened for various countries around the world where they were printing loads of money and therefore suddenly... You know, a loaf of bread was costing a million of their currency, million pounds equivalent to their currency, yeah, because there was so much in circulation. And what we're trying to do in the UK is to stop that from happening by addressing things from an economic level. But yes, in theory, unfortunately, you can't just print more money. It will lead to knock-on effects, like things rising in price.
Okay, net worth.
Net worth is your assets less your liabilities. So everything you have in terms of any asset you have. So any cash that you hold, gold, investments, property, you could even put your jewelry in, whatever. If that's considered an asset to you, that is an asset. To get to your net worth, you deduct your liabilities from that. So any credit card debt you have, any mortgage you have, any expenses, regular expenses coming out, and that will give you your net worth. Often when we hear celebrities' net worths, it's very skewed, because what they'll tend to do is like list all their properties out and their millions of pounds and assume things like their income and then forget to deduct their liabilities because they probably might have mortgages. Mm-hmm. And then it gives you what's called your net worth. Mm-hmm. It can be a really nice metric to find out, because actually it's a really good starting point for many people, and mm-hmm. then you can work from there.
And then tax versus VAT.
So technically, VAT is a type of tax. So tax in general, for most people in the UK, we know the big three, which is income tax, national insurance, and VAT. And they actually contribute the most amount of money to our UK government. VAT stands for value added tax. So value added tax is added on to products across the board. Whereas you might have, and that's kind of a general tax, a VAT, that you don't often see split out as a general person. As a business owner, you might see it split out, but for most people, they don't know it as a separate tax. Versus income tax and national insurance is very much an employment tax you see on your payslip.
Okay, so hopefully that helped. And hopefully people have realised that I am so not great with this myself. You know, there's so much.
That's okay. That's why you bring in an expert.
You know, run a very successful business. And I suppose the reason I'm very open about it, it's like, I have no shame in being like, you what? Mm. Or explain it for us or dumb it down, because we're not supposed to know all this stuff. And they, like you said, they don't teach you at school. And don't be embarrassed to ask. Like, if somebody's having a conversation about it with you, you know, people actually like to feel intelligent. If I was to say to someone, hey, I actually don't know what this means that you're talking about, could you explain it? That's actually quite nice for that person, because yeah, they're like, oh my God, I can share some knowledge. So kind of, if you're feeling embarrassed about asking, remind yourself of that.
Yeah.
Like, actually, it's a nice thing to be able to be inquisitive, to be curious, and to just be like, you know what, I don't know.
Exactly. And do you know what's even more worrying is the amount of guys in my life sometimes that spout finance knowledge. And then I'm like, can you explain that? And they're like, I don't know, especially crypto. Drives me mad. And they've all got an opinion on it. And they're like, oh, well, I'm right. And I'm like, explain to me what crypto is. And they're like, oh, blah, 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 blah. And I'm like, nope, that's wrong. And I hold some delight in correcting people. But I would say that to a lot of people is like, if you are confused by what someone's saying, it's chances are it's because they don't really get it themselves. And if they can't explain it simply, they shouldn't be explaining it. I would always call people out and just ask more questions, because no, like you said, no one is going to be upset about imparting their knowledge onto someone else. And I would say that as well. If you think that you are confident enough to explain something when it comes to finances, please talk to your girlfriends about it. Please talk to your friends about it, because that's what we need to change as a shift to help people feel more confident about it.
Yeah. I want to talk about pensions, because I actually just was working with the People's Pension on their pension drop campaign to try and encourage more young people. And to be honest, I only started paying into my pension 2 years ago.
Ah, okay.
And now I do like the max amount, because I'm like, yes, why wouldn't I? It's like so tax efficient as like a business owner. And the compound interest you get on it, like it's a no brainer. And yet for years, my dad would say to me, have you put money in your pension? And I'd be like, oh, whatever. Like, who cares? Like, I'm not going to care. You know, especially in my 20s, I'd be like, I'm not going to care what I'm doing when I'm 60. Like, that felt like forever away. Whereas now I'm 35. I'm like, hey, that is not that far away. And I am still going to be living life to the max by then.
Yeah.
60 is not the end of your life, like we used to think it was 20 years ago.
No.
But why do you think so many people do kind of, when they hear pensions, do they just think, no, forget it. Like, I just want to live for the now.
Well, this is the thing. It's a short-termism mindset. You know, our government have something to answer for when it comes to this, because they have very short-termism mindsets, and therefore they instill like they instill these beliefs that it's like, right, here and now, fix things here and now. And actually we should be encouraging people to remember that, you know, 55 isn't a long way away. That's the kind of current retirement age for private pensions is rising. You know, and 66, which is the state pension age retirement, is not that far away either for many people. And we're living so much longer now. And I think specifically as women, we have something called a gender pension gap where we have less in our pension pots overall than our male counterparts. And it's really important that we understand what we need to keep up our current lifestyle in retirement and what that number looks like. And if you can use pensions, like workplace pensions, to get loads of money into that pot, you should. But yeah, a lot of people do. I understand it. You know, it's annoying, especially when you look at your payslip to see that money going somewhere that you're not going to be able to touch for a while. But because of the contributions from your employer and the tax relief that you get from the government, it becomes a really, like a really kind of profitable thing to do.
What do you think if somebody is kind of like, okay, I'm going to give it a go, I'm going to do it, what's their first step to kind of for their pension?
If you're employed, it'd be to look at your workplace pension. What do they offer? If they are willing to contribute more, can you contribute more in a short period of time? If you are self-employed, look at something called a SIP, so a self-invested personal pension, where you basically pay into your equivalent of a workplace pension, but you're doing it yourself. And then also check your state pension amount. So in the UK, it's not a lot, like don't get excited about this, but basically we have something called the state pension where you get to 66, you may be entitled to a small amount of money every week. I think it's around £260, so it's not gonna be able to sustain your entire life. But it is enough that you wanna keep an eye on whether you've contributed, because to get the full state pension, you have to have contributed minimum of 35 full years of national insurance contributions, which is one of those employment taxes I said on your payslip. So basically you have to have worked for 35 years. The majority of millennials, Gen Zs, Gen A, that's not even gonna be difficult because we are gonna have to work for a very long period of time. But
because that include self-employment?
Yes, if you're paying national insurance, yes. Right. But for some people, if you're self-employed and earning less than 12,570, you might therefore not pay national insurance and therefore not get those contribution years. If, or for instance, you take unpaid care leave, you know, there's lots of reasons. If you're a mother, you might take a few years off. What I would stress is if you register for child benefit, even if you don't take the money, it does contribute to those years. So it can stop you from missed years. But yeah, a lot of people have a quick check that you're on track to reach those 35 years and make sure that you're eligible and therefore take the state pension. There's a question of whether it will still be there by the time Gen Z and Gen A get to retirement age, but for now it still is, so definitely look into it.
Right, let's now move on quickly to investing. In very simple terms, what is investing?
Investing looks different to everyone, but for the majority of people, it will look like investing in what's called asset classes to hopefully get a return in the future. Mm-hmm. So an asset class could be anything from cash to gold, all the way through to stocks and shares, which are like traditionally what we think of when we think of investing, REITs, bonds. These are all things that you would buy, assets effectively, that you hope in a period of time would grow in value and you could sell it and then take money out. Traditionally, when it comes to investing, most people in the UK use what's called a stocks and shares ISA when they invest in equities, which are also stocks and shares. And it's because in the UK, we offer the ISA wrapper, which means any income you make from those investments is tax-free. So in a very quick way, that is investing. You are buying an asset now, hoping that it will grow in value in the future. Investing obviously does come with risk because value, all of those assets can go up in value and also come down. But the longer that you're investing, you find that generally that risk massively drops and you are someone that will eventually, your portfolio hopefully should rise. When it comes to equities as well, you can have what's called index funds, whereas instead of investing in just one stock or share, you can invest in groups of them.
I also only just started doing my ISA.
Okay.
And Wolf's.
Nice.
Which is great. Can you talk a little bit about doing kids' ISAs?
Yeah.
That's been, I thought, was so brilliant.
Yeah, junior ISAs are brilliant. Investing for your kids. I always would always say, obviously, put your own mask on before helping others. Make sure you're maxing out your own ISA first. But if you are looking to support your children, there's tons of ways. So you have junior ISAs. These are, you can put up to $9,000 per child per tax year into an ISA. You don't have to put nine in. You can put in £10. But this is a way to build up a portfolio. It can be in cash or investments. And that cannot be touched by them until they turn 18. Something to be aware of as a parent is once they turn 18, that money is theirs and theirs entirely.
Oh, shit.
Yeah, and yeah. So financial education is really important because once they turn 18, you have no rights over that money.
Wow.
And if they decide to go off, it depends how much is in there, but they decide to go off and buy an very expensive car, there's nothing you can do to stop them because it's their money.
I would consider that.
Yeah, just That's be really so careful the closer you get. You also have accounts like premium bonds or just junior savings accounts that are there for children. Premium bonds can be fun for like grandparents to put in because they can set them up for their grandchildren. Mm. Yeah, like I said, the ISA though for juniors is really fun, and that's a way that I don't, have you told Wolf that he has one?
Yes, I have, but then I think he just keeps thinking it's like his money now, so he keeps being like, well, I'm just going to buy it myself because I've got this much money in my bank account.
Yeah,
and I'm like, no, it's not yours yet, and also can we be grateful for that? It's not for you to go and buy some like Robux.
Yeah, well, this is the thing,
fuck's sake.
So when I'm teaching in junior schools, that will be the thing that if I was in Wolf's class, that'd be the thing he'd say, because I'd say, who's got junior ISA, and kids would be like, I do, and I've got this much, and I'm like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
Love that for you. But I would say, yeah, that's a really good conversation to be having with them, to remind them that it's not money now, it's money in the future. And you need to hold their hand really firmly once they turn 18 and just make sure that they don't do anything nuts.
I mean, Wolf loves talking about money.
That's so cool.
Yeah, he does. He's always like, he's always like, how much is this? How much is that? And I'm like trying to be like, I want to talk to him about money because I think that understanding money and maths and business can be so beneficial. And I am not in any way, I would rather he didn't go to university personally.
Yeah.
So if he wants to have some entrepreneurial spirit, I'd love to instill that in him now. But I also then as a border, I don't want him to become obsessed with money. Do you know what I mean? So it's like, there's such a balance, isn't there? Of like, I want to educate you, but I don't want you going to school and suddenly talking about money and then because you're not supposed to talk about money with friends.
I know, this is a thing.
So it's actually really difficult.
It is. And they do, it's habits, and they do grow out of certain things as well. Obviously they know what's right and wrong. And if them talking about money is making someone else feel sad about themselves, they shouldn't be doing it. And hopefully they realize that as a young person.
Yeah.
But it is important that they talk about it. I do something with my year ones and twos and threes where I get them to write down the values of everyday items, and we talk about it because some young people really don't have any concept of what things cost, and we're talking about a pair of jeans and they'll write down £300, and I'm like, unless your mum is going to Prada and finding you your own she's kicking you out, they're not £300. And I think it can really distort kids' minds around money, so it is important to talk to them about it. But obviously I think the way to talk about it with your young kids and also still be respectful is to say, never talk about money if it makes someone else feel sad about themselves.
I feel like I could talk to you all day about this, and I personally have so many questions. I am definitely on my own journey with I've started working with a financial advisor, and I really want to understand this more. And I'm sure, my dad forever was trying to explain bonds to me, but he was way too clever that he just couldn't make it simple for me.
That's fine.
As much as he tried, he couldn't. And so now I'm really taking it upon myself to try and educate myself more, do things like pensions, do things like putting things in the stock market, and even understanding basic things like money or cash sitting in a bank account is probably one of the worst places where you can save money.
Yep.
You get nothing back on it really, or minimal. Even things he had actually set it up for me, bless him, a couple of weeks before he passed, which was putting things in notice accounts for me. Mm. So it's you can put it in for 3 to 6 months and you get a slightly higher interest than you would at the bank. So at least that can be a really simple way to invest short term and not having to put something in for 5 years or 10 years.
Yeah.
So I think it actually does feel quite empowering when you just start educating yourself a little bit.
It's such a wonderful way to show that you love someone as well, isn't it? Your dad did that for you. And I think a lot of people hold these really negative emotions around money and talking about money. And I'm like, it's the way I show most of my friends that I love them is by telling them off when they don't get their finances right. No, I don't tell them off. But I show my community that I love them by being right, budgets come out, this is how I'm going to explain it in the simplest way possible. Or I'll say to friends, you've just had a baby, please can I send you a Notion board that's got all of the lists of the bank accounts I would suggest, and this is what I would look at doing. And that's how I show people I care.
Aww.
And actually, it's really it's really important that you like that we instill that as well in yeah. like ourselves, to remember that just because we're doing something and it's got a financial element doesn't mean it's greedy or selfish. Actually, yeah. it's just another way of an act of service.
Absolutely. No, I love that. Okay, we are going to end on a quick fire round.
Okay.
One money habit everyone should stop immediately.
Comparing your day one to someone else's day 50.
The most misunderstood thing about budgeting.
That it's restrictive. It doesn't have to be. Automate at the beginning of the month and it can be an absolute breeze.
The first thing to fix if money feels completely out of control.
Look through your bank statements and highlight any leaks. So anything that you're spending money on that you didn't either realize or you could get away with not buying.
One avoided money task that will give you instant relief once it's done.
Pay slips. Read your pay slip. Once you've read it once, you really don't have to look at it that in much detail ever again, but you can just quickly check in and make sure the numbers are right.
The best place for a beginner to start with investing.
So finding a platform that they like, opening within that a stocks and shares ISA, and then making sure that what they're investing in, it makes sense to them. Most people will start with what's called an index fund. So index funds are things like the S&P 500, where you track the top 500 US companies, or the FTSE All World, which tracks equities mm-hmm. across the world. They can be a really great place to start.
One money rule you live by that has changed everything.
That it is about your mindset. Catch yourself when you are talking badly about money and try and stop yourself as often as you can because money does attract the people that talk about money in a really positive way.
Love that. And the last question is, what does rising mean to you?
Rising for me has meant fake it until it becomes a reality. So I haven't always, and especially in the last year, I've had a really difficult year, and I think there was so much of last year I had to fake confidence, but rising out of that was genuinely from like faking it a lot of the time and putting on a smile when I didn't feel like it, and then it eventually just became who I was, and now I can actually sit here and feel confident and relaxed, which is nice.
Oh, I love that. Abby, thank you so much for such a brilliant guest on Rise with Roxy. Thank you so much for listening to that episode with Abby. You know, I definitely think even as I was listening, I was kind of like, oh gosh, some of these terms. And, you know, I think money can just feel so, so overwhelming. And perhaps this is an episode that you maybe just listen back again with some notes. Abby suggested loads of great tips. And I think even if you just do one or two of them, you can at least get yourself on that path to feeling more in control. So maybe it is just looking at your PAYE. Maybe it is just doing that. I loved the automations at the beginning of the month and making yourself like a fun pot. That is definitely like such a good one, because then you can like, you almost like give yourself permission to like spend something guilt-free when the time comes. And you're like, you know what? I deserve that. I owe it to myself. So yeah, really, really enjoyed that. I'll definitely be doing some of those and hope it helped. If it did, please do leave a comment, share, subscribe. It helps so, so much. And we are so grateful for your support always. So thank you so much. And yeah, I'll see you on Thursday for my solo episodes, and back again on Monday for another incredible episode of Rise with Roxy. A Rayo Original Podcast.